This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with longtime Washington insider Joe Califano. Joseph Califano was Secretary of the Department of Health and held several positions on Capitol Hill, an accomplished lawyer, and a Washington insider drawing on decades of experience to deliver a blistering critique of the state of American government. His book is Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. Joseph Califano will also comment on the health issues that are obviously in place regarding these mass shootings. One yesterday in Florida has left 17 people dead. Also, Michael Finkel, accomplished journalist chasing the last American hermit, a man who lived 27 years in the woods, an amazing story. And Anthony Davenport on the importance of being vigilant about our credit scores. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we start our show today with a special guest indeed, Joseph Califano. 30 years in Washington, he served at the Pentagon on the White House staff. The New York Times called him Deputy President for Domestic Affairs. In the cabinet as U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and Joseph Califano spent years as an attorney on Wall Street and in Washington, representing the Washington Post during Watergate and clients as varied as the Black Panthers and Coca-Cola. He also was the attorney at one point for Daniel Shore, an ultra-liberal, and an uber-conservative, Peter Grace. His latest work is Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. And good morning to you, Mr. Joseph Califano.
Oh, it's great. It is great to talk to you and be here.
Well, it's good to hear your distinctive voice. And if our listeners would like to touch base with you, the number is 877-217-5757. And you can always dial locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. As far as where our government is right now, there are many who say we're not where we should be, but you believe it's at a crisis point. What is going on?
Well, I think it is at a crisis point. I think that over the last 50 years, we've seen several things happen. The presidency has amassed a colossal amount of power. So the president's become the chief legislator, basically, with all the regulations he issues. Think about this. These presidents over those years have sent millions of Americans into combat. 100,000 have been killed. 1 million have been wounded. There's been no declaration of war. And the Congress itself is crippled. It is consumed with raising money, and it's partisan, and to me most quite troubling, the political parties are almost becoming racially divided, which is a very serious problem for this country. Go ahead.
Well, when you say racially divided, in the South in particular. In Louisiana, and it's a national phenomenon, but in Louisiana, for example, Mr. Califano, about 80% or 85% of whites vote for Republicans and 95% of blacks vote for Democrats. Is that what you're talking about?
Sure. Since the last Democratic president to get a majority of the white vote was Lyndon Johnson in 1964, the landslide over Barry Goldwater, who was the president I worked for on the White House staff. And that's one. Now, secondly, in the Congress, generally, in the South, all the Republicans, congressmen are white, and all the Democratic congressmen are black. And the numbers, if I could just a second, the last political conventions in 2016, the Democratic convention, 50% of the delegates were white, 25% black, 15% Latino. The Republican convention, 94% white, less than 1% black, 5% Latino. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I want the Republican Party to have more African Americans. I want them to have more Latinos. We do not want a situation in this country where the parties become divided on the basis that we're tilting towards now.
How dangerous is that for our democracy?
Well, I think it is dangerous for our democracy. One of the problems in Congress is that there's no compromise. Compromise has become a dirty word in Washington. It's a four-letter word. Several things add to that. The gerrymandering, which pushes when you have when you've got a district gerrymandered to the either for the right or the left, the candidates in the Democratic Party are going to be towards the left that are going to win, and the right Republican Party towards the right, and they're going to make commitments that they won't give on anything, and they don't. Then you get to Washington, and the Democrats will be particularly protective of African Americans, and Latinos, and the Republicans will be particularly protective of whites, not because they're racist, I'm not implying that, but because they're looking at the people who vote for them. And I'm saying, let's reach out. We have to reach out. The Republicans got 8% of the African-American vote in the last presidential election. Hillary Clinton got 88, and that was low for the Democrats. Democrats usually get more than 90%.
Yeah.
We need to change that. It is one of the things, it's one of the fault lines I point out in the book. I mean, there are a lot of others that are serious and systemic.
Well, in the South, in 1976, Jimmy Carter carried all 11 states of the Southeastern Conference. In 2016, Donald Trump carried all 11 states of the Southeastern Conference, most of them by huge margins, including Louisiana, Florida being the only close state. This is a region that the Democrats, on a national level, and even in these congressional races, the Democrats have largely given up on the South. How can a party be a national party and give up on a whole region of the country?
Well, let me say, we might disagree a little on this. I don't think the Democrats gave up on the South. When I was working for Lyndon Johnson, the night he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which eliminated segregation and opened up public accommodations to prohibited discrimination in employment, the night he signed that law, he said, we are turning the South over to the Republican Party for my lifetime and yours. And that was the driving wedge, and it happened. It's happened. Well, he was right, but he was willing to do it. I think the South is changing, though. I mean, I think look at the tremendous increase in, let's say, immigration from the other states. It's more comfortable to live there. It's not, you don't have snow and ice storms and what have you. The large manufacturing plants, Toyota and what have you, coming into the South. I think that will change as it moves to another generation.
Yeah, but on the immigration issue, Joseph Califano, isn't that part of it that Democrats would like to see? Many of these people become citizens and presume that they will vote for the Democratic candidates, and Republicans want to stop this at all costs.
Well, some Republicans and some Democrats. I think, sure, I think there's no question that are likely to become Democrats. I think also because people who are now supporting them in districts they represent are people who, are Hispanics, Latinos, who have family they want to get in or friends they want to get in. I understand that. I am not an expert on immigration. I do think that there's a lot of political motivation. On the other hand, look at the last couple of days. I mean, a significant number of Democratic and Republican senators have come together and proposed a plan. And that's something I don't think anyone would have predicted 2 or 3 years ago. And at least they're talking to each other. Let me think about this. One of the things I say is in Congress, one of the reasons they're crippled is they don't talk to each other. There's no, look at this. In the House Intelligence Committee, the Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives of the United States, the chairman and the ranking Democratic member, Nunes and Schiff, they don't talk to each other. The chairman writes a memo. He sends it to the president, goes to the FBI, and he puts it out. The Democrat then writes one. They're now putting up a wall to separate their staffs. Now, if you're Russia meddling in our elections, and you look at the House Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives, and these two guys, they can't even talk to each other. They say, "Wow, what an opportunity! This place is broken." I worry about that.
We're hearing the voice of Joseph Califano Jr. He spent more than three decades in Washington. He was at the side of President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Hard to believe that man's been dead now for 45 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is an amazing time that we're living in, and a lot of the issues that began during the Civil Rights era continue to percolate today. And we're going to talk some more with Joseph Califano after a brief time out of 90 Seconds. His book is Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. And in the book, Joe Califano talks about the politicized high court and the fractured media, and how regard for media breaks along party lines as cable news and internet sites shape facts and opinions conservative or liberal customers long to hear and fail to tell the way it is, as Walter Cronkite once did. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're back after this 90-second pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Eakster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Our special guest for another segment is Joseph Califano. He spent 30 years in Washington. He's an accomplished attorney in addition to serving in the government at the highest levels, and the founder of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. His 14th book is Our Damaged Democracy, fresh off the presses, and we're here to talk with him about what he believes is a crisis in our government, including what you call the politicized court. What do you mean?
Well, if you look at the Supreme Court, over the last 10 years, 50 decisions have split 4 Democrats and 4 Republicans, with Anthony Kennedy being the deciding vote. So we have that. That's number one. And these are split right along party lines. They voted their party line, and that really is a serious problem. It's beyond, you know, different ideologies, or we understand that Roosevelt went through that during the New Deal. These are party line votes. And the other politicization is now when the President Trump or anybody else, President Obama, looks for a candidate for the Supreme Court, they want somebody that will surely follow their views. And so they pick judges from lower courts, so they know what they believe on, whether it's the issue of choice versus abortion, whether it's gun rights or what have you. They want somebody that'll follow it. They then send that candidate to the Congress, and we go through what I call a theater of the absurd sometimes in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where senators try and elicit, make believe they don't know what the guy's or gal's position is and go after them. The whole process has become politicized, and the last candidate, and we're not picking, not saying I want somebody of enormous integrity. I want somebody that's a fantastic lawyer or jurist. It's very troubling, and it affects the whole federal court system. The federal district courts, you know, blow out Obama's immigration plan, you go to the Eastern District of Texas and you got a national injunction that says it's unconstitutional. If you want to blow out Trump's immigration plan, you go to San Francisco, where you have a judge, Bill Orrick, who's a Democrat, big Democratic contributor, and you blow out Trump's plan. We can't have a system like that. And it shows that the Pew Research polls show that the tremendous decline in respect for the Supreme Court and the whole federal court system.
You also have grave misgivings about what's going on with the media and the attack on the American media.
Yeah, two things, two parts. One is nobody in America has to look at anybody, has to look at anything they don't like on television. You can, I can go to Fox News and get my view reinforced every minute. I can go to MSNBC and get my view reinforced any minute. And I go to CNN, it's pretty, getting pretty close to MSNBC. So we have we have this world in which there are, you mentioned Walter Cronkite before, there are no Walter Cronkites, but public radio is our, is our one of our big sources of state radio, like yours is one of our sources that produces news, facts, and people shouldn't be afraid. You should hear things they don't agree with. They might change their mind, or they might just get angry. So we have that problem, which I think is a serious problem, and I think there's. The social media produced this world where you can say anything about anybody or anything about any situation, and false or true, often false, and before somebody gets a chance to correct it, millions of people have seen it.
Dan downtown. Let's see if we can get Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Joseph Califano. We're talking with him a few more minutes. His book is Our Damaged Democracy. Hi, Dan.
Yes, Califano, is part of the problem also that if a trial court judge hopes to be promoted to the appellate court, he or she will rule in the way that they figure the administration sees things.
All right.
Be part of the problem. And that also really affects the court system. I think that could well be part of the problem.
877-217-5757. Several listeners have asked about this terrible tragedy yesterday in Florida. 17 people dead in a shooting at a high school. And this, unfortunately, is more common than not. Joseph Califano mentioned that you've been involved in addiction, substance abuse, mental illness, those things. But is this an issue that goes beyond that?
I think we have to get much better at dealing with mental illness in this country. In the context of what happened there, I think this was truly a mentally disturbed person. We have to provide mental health services for people like that, and poverty can produce depression and anger and what have you. So we have to find a way, perhaps through Medicaid, perhaps through state programs. We used to provide them in most state programs, to provide some serious mental health help. And when we identify true dangers, dangerous people, we have to give them treatment. This is an awful, awful tragedy. And, my wife and I almost cried over it last night to listen to some of those students on television. It was very disturbing.
877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Joseph Califano.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's an honor to have an audience with you, Mr. Califano. What was your reaction when you heard President Trump appointed a lady to head the Center for Disease Control who has a financial interest in a Japanese tobacco company? And I know you've been a strong advocate against the horrors of tobacco. And furthermore, the Republican Trump budget proposed for the Center of Disease Control. How much damage do you think that would do to the health and welfare of this nation?
Joseph Califano.
I think it was an outrageous appointment. She fortunately withdrew. Tobacco kills 400,000 in this country, and I have to Jim,
You have to go. I know you have another one after me, but
thank you.
But it's been a pleasure, and thank you.
Thank you.
It's very good to hear from Joseph Califano. His book is Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. And coming next is Michael Finkel, an American journalist who has written many books that have been well-received. He was a writer for the New York Times until 2002. And his latest work is quite an accomplishment and a story that you probably wouldn't think an accomplished journalist would pursue. It's called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit, about a man who spent 27 years in the woods. And it's a remarkable culmination of a long career in journalism for this fine gentleman, Michael Finkel, who will be joining us in just a moment. Michael, when he was writing for the New York Times, he discovered that he discovered a lot of nuggets that he unearthed in a story written about the American slave trade, and he is best known for that. But this one is one that I think he may get the same kind of attention for. It's such an unusual story. It's about the life of Christopher Thomas Knight, a hermit who lived alone in the woods in the North Pond area in Maine. Amazingly, that somebody could last in Maine with no means of support in the cold, treacherous terrain of Maine for 27 years. And your number is 877-217-5757. Also later, Anthony Davenport on the importance of being vigilant about your credit score. Now the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest at this time is Michael Finkel, the author of True Story, Murder Memoir, Mea Culpa, which was adapted into a major motion picture. He's written for National Geographic, GQ, Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine. He joins us from Western Montana, and his latest book is The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Good morning, Michael Finkel.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
It's nice to talk with you. The gentleman we're talking about is named Christopher Knight, and he is a fascinating character, isn't he?
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that this is a true story. There's some things we're probably going to talk about that might boggle belief, but this is not a novel or fake news. It's been thoroughly fact-checked. This is a true story.
How did you find this man?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm talking to you from my home in Montana, but one morning, just sort of cruising the corners of the internet, I came across a small story in a Maine paper, and literally every line of the story defied belief. They said a man was just arrested for stealing hamburger meat and cheese at a summer camp that was closed for the season, and he claimed to have spent the previous 27 years living all by himself in the woods of Maine, not speaking with anyone, never seen the internet, never used the toilet indoors, never lit a fire, he claimed, never once got sick, and on and on. And I'm like, I don't know if I can believe this, and wanted to know what he would say, waited for a follow-up, and being a hermit, he said nothing. And eventually I decided, well, what the heck, I'm going to write him a letter. He's being held in jail on these thievery charges. And I figured, here's a guy who rejected modern life. Maybe he would prefer a handwritten letter, you know, that old-fashioned thing, ink, paper, envelopes, stamps, and mailed him a letter to the Kennebec County Jail in central Maine. And to my surprise and delight, I received a note back, and that's the way our relationship started.
Well, did Christopher Knight want to talk to anybody? Did he want to be interviewed?
No. That's a good question. I didn't know it at the time, but it turned out that something like 500 journalists got in touch with him. And it is sort of catnip for journalists. You've got like a mystery, a true crime, a legend, a tale of survival. There was many different opinions about Chris Knight's behavior. And then, of course, you know, questions like what happens to a guy after he's been living alone in the woods and then he's thrown back into our society. So dozens of different questions. And I think he realized that he would be bugged by journalists to tell the story unless he actually did tell it to one. And to my delight, I'm really can't thank Chris Knight enough. He selected to respond to me. And from that first letter he wrote back to me, I knew a few things. At first, I was just like concerned that he was just going to be a crazy man, that there was going to be no real reason to talk to him, but his letter was beautifully written, highly intelligent, funny at times, and so I knew that this was a guy with a good head on his shoulders and even had a little sense of, you know, a sense of humor and had an incredible story to share. And, you know, first we did a series of letters, which is a nice way to break the ice with someone who's extremely introverted. You know, letters are a great way. You don't have to sit in front of each other. And then eventually we progressed to interviews in jail while he was awaiting a word of what might happen to him.
He was 20 years old when he disappeared, correct?
Yeah, which is really young. You know, I think one of the operative questions is, you know, why? Why would you escape the world, especially so thoroughly and so young? And of course, I asked him that question, and he said that in his life, and again, this is before the age of 20, so it's not like great deal of life, but in high school and a little bit after, he said he always felt really uncomfortable around other people, and he described it as this gravitational tug, which was asking him to go off by himself. And there have been hermits throughout history, throughout human history, and many of them have said similar things. They just felt this urge to be alone. There wasn't any specific thing, not a crime committed, not a moment. It was just this tug. And he drove his car. He had purchased the first new car of his life, and you know, listen, I was 20 years old once. I remember being quite impulsive and impetuous, and he literally drove this car in deep into the woods of Maine, dropped the keys in the center console, and with very little food and almost no supplies, walked into the woods and didn't come out for close to 30 years. It was, you know, the why is just this tug, and I think a more interesting or a deep question is, why did he stay? And his answer to that, again, we can get into it further, is that he really liked it. Like, you might think he suffered or was cold and was hungry, and he was all of those things, but he expressed this deep satisfaction with the radically unorthodox life he chose to live. And there was even times when I was talking to him that I was almost a little jealous of his experiences.
Well, we're talking about some rugged territory as well. How did he survive?
Yeah, the woods of Maine are, especially this central Maine, are very thick, like Brillo pad thick, and during the last ice age, they were covered with glaciers, and when the glaciers retreated, they left behind all these enormous boulders, which are covered with moss. It's very difficult to navigate. And Chris found this amazing spot in the woods. He, for the first 2 years or so of his, I guess you could call it his retreat, he sort of wandered around the woods of Maine and then finally found this spot and settled in there for a quarter century, and nobody apparently ever found him. He was so well hidden and not that far from other homes. And came up with ingenious ways to survive. Maine winters are brutal. I'm here in Montana. We have cold weather, but Maine has wet and windy cold, like the worst kind of cold. And he never once lit a fire. He didn't want smoke to give his campsite away, and came up with, he's blessed with an extremely good head on his shoulder for both, you know, book intelligence and just, you know, an ability to solve difficult problems. And despite never getting a single word of advice from an adult after the age of 20, anyone older than him, came up with multiple survival methods. And after 27 years, when he was finally caught, was healthy and strong and had no intention of voluntarily coming out.
What did he look like?
Okay, so in your mind, I'm thinking, okay, we're talking about a hermit. You know, you're thinking of this big, long, disheveled, bearded person, but One of the many aspects of this story that I like is that it subverts a lot of your expectations. So Chris Knight, as we mentioned, for his food and his clothing and his reading material, often broke into unoccupied summer cabins around these ponds in central Maine. He never broke a window or kicked in a door. He had a Houdini-esque ability to pick locks and made sure that no one was home. That doesn't excuse him, of course, as he will say, but he always, when he went on these thieving raids, he would shave himself very neatly, almost shave his hair completely gone, and wear clean clothes, which he cleaned using a bucket of water and rubbing it against a rock. And so in case somebody saw him, they might think, oh, it's just someone out for an evening stroll. So he didn't look at all like a hermit. It was only after he was arrested and was no longer a hermit that he allowed his beard to grow crazy and his hair to grow long. And so he, when he was no longer a hermit, he looked exactly like one. And when he was a hermit, he looked nothing like one.
It is an amazing story. Was he emaciated?
Chris Knight sort of lived in I think we all live like, what day of the week is it and what time is it? And Knight lived in a more seasonal existence. He had a radio, so he was aware of the date generally, but really it was the arc of the seasons that dictated his lifestyle. And like animals, he compared himself often to animals. Before winter comes, you probably know, most of the animals in cold climates get themselves as fat as possible. They gorge themselves on food. And Chris Knight did the same thing. He would eat sugar. Sometimes he would drink a little alcohol. He would try and get himself as fat as possible for the winter because he liked to not only have no sign of smoke from his campsite, he also didn't like to make a single footprint in the snow. And there's a lot of snow in Maine. So often for 5 and 6 months, he would be cooped up or alone in his site without leaving. And he tried to stockpile a lot of food, but he went from somewhat fat at the beginning of winter to very emaciated at the end of winter. Sometimes he felt like he would barely survive it, and then restart the cycle of putting on weight again, similar to an animal.
Well, why in the world did he return if he was surviving? And I guess now we're into his late 40s. So what prompted the return?
Chris Knight, according to him, was never going to come out of the woods, and he did not voluntarily come out. He became somewhat of a mystery. Now, you have to remember, this lasted for 27 years, and the homeowners of these little cottages around the lake, none of them were permanent homes. You know, they were missing things, but it was unusual. Again, there was no broken doors or windows, and your computer was there, and your television is there, and your jewelry's there, but a chicken is missing, and your flashlight, and your Stephen King novel. You know, you call the police and you tell them, listen, my Stephen King novel's gone, but everything else valuable is here, and there's no sign of entry. They're not going to really put a team of officers on it. So it sort of slipped between the cracks, but this legend built up in, like, 27 years, people that grew up hearing about mysterious person in the woods, and they gave him a name. They called him the North Pond Hermit, and was like, you know, there's like the Himalayan Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, and the North Pond Hermit. People grew up listening to these legends, had kids of their own. Nobody really believed it. And finally, after more than a quarter century, the local game warden became totally obsessed. There were things missing. Something was happening. And in his free time, you know, used all this homeland security equipment. I won't get into the details, but put a high-tech surveillance finally in the woods and caught Chris Knight in the act of stealing some hamburger meat and some cheese from a summer camp that was closed for the season. And it turned out that the myth was real, and it would be as if, like, a dinosaur, a brontosaurus, walked out of Loch Ness in Scotland. It was, like, that unbelievable. The truth was actually more startling than the myth.
Where is he now?
Good question. So Chris, you know, there wasn't just the survival story and the nuts and bolts and why did he go and the philosophy of being alone. One of the very interesting aspects of the book and the story is what happens to a guy who's been completely free, living in the woods, and then he's pulled out of the woods. And at first they put him, Chris Knight, in jail, which, though he claimed always, you know, he deserved to be in jail. He was a thief. He was raised with very rigid morals in his family and knew he was doing wrong. But he only spent 7 months in jail and then was released. And then actually things got even more complicated because he was really put out into society. And a person who had never seen the internet or used a cell phone is suddenly in this very fast-paced, very loud, crowded, even in Maine, just a very oppressive sort of environment. And one of the questions the book asks, and I don't want to give too much away, is how does a person like this who didn't voluntarily come out, How does he cope with the world? I don't want to give too much away, but not well is what I can say.
Well, the book is The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit from Michael Finkel. It is an amazing story about Christopher Knight, and we thank you for sharing it with us today. Thank you, Mike.
Jim, thank you so much for having me on the show.
See you soon. Another segment to go with Anthony Davenport, and a reminder that at 10 o'clock, the president will address the nation. This is Jim Inkster. Our guest at this time is Anthony Davenport. He founded a credit management firm that now represents many professional athletes, celebrities, and top financial professionals. He's been featured in Forbes, Yahoo, Finance, and many other publications, and he's taught financial literacy to NFL athletes, lives in Brooklyn, and his latest work is Your Score, an insider's secrets to understanding, controlling, and protecting your credit score. And good morning to you, Anthony Davenport.
Good morning to you, Jim.
You say you used to work for the dark side. What do you mean?
Well, I was a banker for about 10 years out in Seattle. I did primarily mortgage lending at Bank of America and Wells Fargo, and I couldn't do it anymore. After that time period, I saw how flawed the system was. I saw practices like the banks would forbid us from coaching and advising people on how the credit systems work. You're not allowed to do that in almost every bank.
Really?
Forbidden, yeah.
Why?
Because then the banks make less money off of you.
Well, you discovered something about credit reports and credit scores, and these things really affect people's lives probably far more than we know.
They impact you in a wide range of ways. So number one is that you obviously pay more for mortgages or car loans or credit cards, things like that. But people don't understand that employers are looking at credit. 70% of them are. Auto loans are obviously taking a look at it, but even auto insurance and home insurance is now looking at your credit score.
What goes into a credit score?
The biggest chunk, and that's the part that most people take a look at, is that 35% of your FICO score comes down to whether you pay your bills on time. So that makes sense. Most people will understand that. But 65% of your FICO score has nothing to do with whether you pay your bills on time.
What is that? Well, what does that include?
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, right? So the next biggest chunk is 30% of your FICO score comes down to whether you have credit card balances or not and what those balances are. And what trips up most people is that it doesn't matter how much money you make. You can make $1 million a year. You can make $10,000 a year. If you have a credit card with a limit of, let's say, $500, and then you're near the limit on that $500, it massively impacts your FICO score. They don't take income into account. So, and you got to remember that they're also only updating the credit bureaus every 30 to 45 days. So you could pay off your balance in full each month, yet your FICO score can vary wildly based upon like a small limit credit card. And that hangs up so many people, and that's one of the reasons why I said we have to write a book and tell people about how this whole system works, how it's built against you, how you're not meant to know the rules, and they make more money off of you despite the fact that you could be a pretty credit-worthy person.
We're visiting with Anthony Davenport. His book is Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. You say that walking into negotiation for a mortgage, a car loan, or other big-ticket line of credit without knowing exactly where your credit score stands is a huge mistake. It makes sense, but how big of a mistake is it?
It's massive, because I saw it from the other side. When people would walk in to get a mortgage, they would just kind of go with fingers crossed, saying, I hope that my credit is where it needs to be. A lot of people would say, I pay my bills on time, so I'm assuming my credit's good. But they never really actually checked it. And even more important than that is, even if they are checking it, they're usually checking it from one of the credit monitoring companies like Equifax, TransUnion, Experian. Or they're taking a look at, you know, Credit Karma or Credit Sesame, and they're thinking that that is accurate. Those reports are far from accurate. They don't contain the same scores. They don't contain the same depth of data as the one that lending institutions use. And they don't want you to have access to it. Mm-hmm. So even if they pull a copy of your credit report, they're not going to give you a copy of it. They're forbidden from doing so. So we, you know, I made sure to cover a couple tips on how the average consumer can get access to the real credit report that they're using.
Well, if you get access to it, that's one thing, but how can you adjust it if it's not working to a particular person's advantage?
Yeah, so that's another hurdle that's really put in front of people is if your credit score isn't what you want it to be, or if there's mistakes on it, as 60 Minutes had a great piece called 40 Million Mistakes about how many mistakes there are on credit reports, and 40 million Americans have mistakes on there. And when you want to correct it, I've got bad news for you. You can write the best letter in the world. You could use gold paper clips, golden envelopes. You could mail it off to the credit bureaus. But just like there's no Easter Bunny, there's no Santa Claus, there's no one that actually opens up your envelope and reads your disputes. They just don't do that. So they have computers that are handling the processing of these things, And a computer is almost never going to actually rectify the issue by just scanning your letter. So, you know, one thing I mentioned in the book is how to get around those computer systems to where you're forcing someone to actually read it, a human that can see it and say, oh, here's all the proof, here's everything, we have to correct this, otherwise this is an educated consumer that will know what to do.
Now, for most of us, the biggest ticket item that we'll buy is a home at some point in our life, if we're fortunate. How important is it to have a good credit score when we're purchasing a home?
Jim, it's the most important time for you to have your credit looking as pretty as possible. So the mark that you really want to hit is above a 740. If you have a middle FICO score of above a 740, which is the middle out of the three different scores you have, you will get access to the best rates, you will get access to the most options, and the banks will fawn over you when it comes time to get that loan. And it can save you, you know, the average home right now, if you have an average credit score versus an amazing high FICO score, you're paying an extra couple hundred dollars per month just for being average. It's huge.
So let's say the difference between a 720 and a 740, could it be substantial?
It is, because they penalize you every 20 points for not having that 740 score. That's one of the joys that they implemented after the last recession. They came out and said, hey, we got to change some things, and among them, we're not going to penalize you every 20 points, where they didn't do that before. They just said either you qualify and you get the loan or you don't.
Well, it's a situation that I'm sure many Americans deal with. How substantial is the issue with bad credit for people who are trying to get by in our country?
Well, you know, we've done some calculations that if you have just average credit, just whatever the average American has, which is just below 700, over the course of your lifetime, you're paying an extra several hundred thousand dollars in interest in the form of credit cards, car loans, mortgages. If you have errors on your credit report, you could get denied jobs. It's significant because it impacts so many aspects of our life these days that it didn't used to. And now if you don't get that knowledge of how it really needs to be handled, it's going to cost you a lot of money.
Well, is the situation permeates. There are ways to address this that you have in your book, and it takes time. You have to show that you're in good stead for how many years?
Really, they want to see 2 years of history plus. So if you wanted to get something like a mortgage and you don't have a two-year history on anything, they're going to say no. You got to move on. So I always tell people that once a year you should sit down, you know, as part of your New Year's resolution or not, and figure out where your credit needs to be in the next year or and what you're going to do for it. So if you're looking to get like a car loan, for example, you should say, all right, I know that a 740 score is going to get me what I want. What steps do I need to take now? How much do I need to reduce credit card debt? You know, that's a big one. How do I deepen my credit profile and history? How do I remove the issues and errors? What to do with collections, which collections are a huge issue. That impacts a third of all Americans right now, and almost everyone is handling them the totally and complete wrong way.
Lastly, with about 30 seconds to go, Anthony, what about student loans? Those have to be an issue.
It's a huge issue, and I dedicated pretty much the majority of a chapter just to dealing with them, because it's now there's almost twice as much student loan debt as there is credit card debt, and it's going to get to that number very, very, very soon. And you have to get a game plan together for them, especially if you find yourself unable to pay them at some point, because they are backed overwhelmingly by the federal government, which has every option to get your money. They're going to use every option to get your money. They can make your life really difficult. So if you're running into troubles, you know, you got to start working out a plan with them in advance. They will work with you.
Well, we do have to run, but Anthony Davenport, an important book, Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. And coming at 10 o'clock, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, will address the nation regarding the school shooting in Florida yesterday. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.